At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello, I'm Jim Cornell, and this is the WalkingPost.com podcast. WalkingPost.com is the news website dedicated to walking, with all the latest on gear, trails, science, events, festivals, books, and more. Before we start this week, just a reminder about the special offer for podcast listeners of 15% off at 8000kicks.com on their shoes, boots, backpacks, and other accessories. And no, we're not making any commission. This podcast is number 19, and it's going out on July the 11th, which is also French Friday, and it's World Population Day, and it's also Blueberry Muffin Day. Sadly, I'm allergic to blueberries, something I developed eating way too many of them in the wilds of Maine, in New England. It's also Day of the Flemish Community, not too many of those in our village. And it is Swimming Pool Day, maybe appropriate given the elevated temperatures. July the 11th is also the day of the Hollywood Bowl opening in 1922, and in 1962 it's the day of the first transatlantic satellite television transmission. It was probably a commercial. For birthdays, a local one, it's the birthday of Robert the Bruce in 1274, and it's also the birthday of Yul Brynner, Giorgio Armani, and loads of people I've never heard of. No walking this past weekend, as I was at a concert in Birmingham with my family, and no, not the Black Sabbath one. It was a bit warmer than it is in Scotland, that's for sure. I guess there was some walking around the canals involved. But for me, it was the first time I was in Birmingham city centre since I was 9, although since then I have made plenty of trips to the NEC. We did go and get some filming in during the week, and I was asked to take some photos of a group of a dozen or so walkers. I'm not sure where they were from, but one had a Roda football shirt, which is from the Netherlands, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they were Dutch. At least they can go home and talk about the glorious Scottish weather. It wasn't that glorious on the West Coast. It was raining when we left and raining when we got home. Let's move on to the podcast proper. Last time we talked about hemp shoes with João Matos from 8000 Kicks, which is also a good description of my legs when I used to play football. And we talked about walking in London and the new London walking maps with Alexandra Goodship from Transport for London. This week we have two more interesting conversations, one with author Bill Laws about his latest book, A Ramble Through the History of Walking, and the other is with Vivian McCarthy, director of African Travel Specialists, Acacia is Africa. But of course, first we take a quick look at some of this week's articles on WalkingPost.com. If you do have news, guest ideas, or subjects to cover, or comments, or you would like to sponsor the podcast or advertise on it, please get in touch via walkingpost.com, or you can just email me, jim@walkingpost.com. So now it's time for our almost brief recap of some of the headlines of the news articles we had on walkingpost.com this past week. £4 million is available in York and North Yorkshire for active travel projects. Mont Adventure Equipment celebrated its UK launch. And free dinosaur walking trails, called Treks, as in T-Rex, have been launched in more than a dozen Leicestershire parks. The final section of the Trent Vale Trail opened, Merrell launched its ProMorph hybrid shoes, and a survey shows women plan to increase their outdoor activity to record levels. England's mayors have pledged a national walking and cycling network, the Adirondack Land Trust and Paul Smith's College in New York State are working to protect 2,800 acres, which includes lots of trails, and the soon-to-be Indonesian capital has been welcoming visitors and locals alike with walking tours of the city. You can read all of these and more at walkingpost.com. Right, let's get going with those two interviews, and I enjoyed them both immensely. Later, we're talking about Bill Law's latest book on walking, but first we're going to learn a little about good places to go walking in Africa. Vivian McCarthy is Director of African Travel Specialists, Acacia is Africa, and with lots of local guides and the fact that McCarthy is a veteran when it comes to trips to that continent, you know that he knows his stuff. Maybe you could set the scene with a bit of the history of the company.
Well, Acacia started life in the 90s with, in those days, doing extended trips right across Africa. So people get on the vehicle, if you like, in London, and except for ferry crossing to France, traveling quickly through France and Spain to Morocco, and traveling by road right across. And that was very much what people did, and certainly how Acacia began life in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s. And those were trips of a lifetime. We had people on those trips who, you know, you're 4, 5, 6 months on the road. This is it's a very different thing. And that's how we started life. That side of the industry has gone a little bit. And we certainly, Acacia's developed into effectively shorter trips, focusing on the areas where, you know, you can see the wildlife. You've got the scenery and the changes of scenery, nice beaches and changes of people and cultures. And that tends to be on the East Africa and Southern Africa for us anyway. And they're shorter trips, so there's more accessible for a wider range of people. That evolution has taken 25, 30 years or so, but that's kind of where we started. And some of us have seen that change right through. I personally joined the company in the early 90s, but I worked previously for other companies that did the same thing. Since, in fact, 1987, I first went to Africa, and I've been working in it or with it ever since. So for me personally, it was a real life changer.
Those early days you mentioned, like the trip through Europe and into Morocco, were they planned itineraries or was it more spontaneous, like you just went wherever you felt?
No, they were planned itineraries and they were sold as a tour, and they went to I wouldn't say a daily itinerary, because that's very difficult when you're crossing the Sahara and crossing Central Africa. But we had effectively itineraries where we would check in with the office in London by telex in those days, and we should be at such and such a place around about 10 weeks in or 4 weeks in. And so, we had a certain framework. We knew what we were doing. It wasn't all on spec or traveling blind. I think, if you like, a generation beforehand, perhaps in the 70s and 60s and 50s, there might have been a bit more really exploratory. But now we had people who were paid money and had us as tour leaders and drivers and did want to get to where we said we were going to go. But they were very flexible. It was a more flexible expedition type trip. And it was an achievement. You know, getting to Nairobi after 4 months or so, or in those days, Johannesburg, in the very early days, Johannesburg after 5 months or so, perhaps a bit longer, you did have a sense of achievement of having made it.
Yeah, I can well imagine. Fast forwarding to today, what kind of holidays and vacations do you provide in terms of activities and locations?
Things have changed greatly. So these days, we run safaris, tours from 3 or 4 days out, to, for instance, out to the Kruger National Park, or in Kenya, out to the Masai Mara National Park. That sort of 3 or 4 days. To 1 or 2 weeks safari around Kenya and Tanzania, or if you like, in South Africa between Johannesburg and Durban, through Kruger, Swaziland to Durban, to 3 or 4 week tours from Cape Town to Victoria Falls. That would be 3 weeks, or adding another week would bring the trip around to Johannesburg, or 6 to 8 weeks between Cape Town and Nairobi, perhaps with another week or two to visit the gorillas, gorilla trekking. So anything really from 3 or 4 days to 8 or 9 weeks we do. And we tend to do it as groups, scheduled departures. So someone traveling on their own, for instance, wouldn't otherwise, perhaps at another destination, might backpack or hostel around. Africa is not quite the same type of destination. You need to have a bit more organization. Many of the highlights, in fact, I'd say, almost want to say all of the highlights, are away from the urban areas, the city centers. Perhaps all would be an exaggeration, but certainly most of the highlights are out in the rural areas, game parks, trekking areas, where it's evolved. And so, of course, it's more accessible. Someone with a week's holiday, or even less, but let's allow for a flight, a week, 2 weeks holiday. Africa is an accessible and practical destination.
Yeah, absolutely. It's got just the same kind of transportation hubs and airports as everywhere else.
It's not quite as developed as everywhere else. It's not, I don't think it's a main, if you like, a mainstream mass market destination. And a bit selfishly, I would hope that it doesn't become one, because the infrastructure there doesn't really support masses of people coming. And I think that's part of its attraction. It's not a bucket and spade holiday destination. It calls for a bit more than that. I would say it's one of those places, one of those destinations where if you've been for the first time, you're in grave danger of wanting to go back and see something else, because of the, you realize, oh, well, I came to Africa to see elephants or to climb Kilimanjaro. And I now realize that actually there's other game reserves, there's other mountains to trek or climb on. And it really does get under your skin in a nice way. To me, it's a magic destination. I fell in love with it when I first went there in the late 80s. And so I could happily talk about it all day.
Sure. What are the misconceptions about going to Africa? And are they misconceptions that you face?
I think one of the misconceptions is that it's always hot. Obviously, you're in equatorial and subtropical areas, so clearly it's got a hot climate oftentimes. But wintertime in South Africa or in Southern Africa, if you're in the middle of the Namibian desert or in central Botswana, it can get remarkably cold at night time. You know, we tell people, look, depending on the time of year, where you're going to need long pants, you know, a jacket or some sort of coverall, good sleeping bag, because in the nighttime it really cools down. Now, there's an advantage to that, and that is it keeps the mosquitoes away and the creepy crawlies at bay. And that to me is one thing. So it's not always blazingly hot, although it can be. And the other misconception is it's not safe because there's wild animals everywhere. That's not really correct at all. There are certainly wild animals, but they are in the game reserves. And even in the game reserves where we're camping, in the game reserves, there's usually some sort of deterrent to keep the mammals away. The biggest dangers, frankly, are much smaller. So, you know, there's a risk down there of malaria in most areas, not everywhere, but in most areas. And we certainly recommend that anyone considering going to Africa speaks to their doctor or travel clinic about sensible health precautions to take. Some areas, there's a requirement for a yellow fever inoculation, but not everywhere. And it's not generally because there's a medical risk of a yellow fever. It's because they've got an overhanging rule from some time past that they haven't lifted. So for Zanzibar, for instance, going on to Zanzibar, the Port Authority checks for yellow fever vaccination certificate. So the insects and the mosquito bites, they don't have to be malarial to be annoying, a bigger risk than anything else. So traveling to Africa brings no more risk than traveling to anywhere else. And I would say considerably less, because we're spending a lot of our time outside of built up urban areas where, you know, there's a risk in any sort of travel for people arriving in new countries. But we do our best to recommend people stay in certain areas, and we book things like pre-accommodation and transfers from the airport and all the stuff that you would expect an operator to help someone who's traveling first time. Many of our clients are first time travelers to Africa, of all ages for that matter. You know, things like booking accommodation before a trip or at the end of it is very common. We do it a lot.
Has climate change affected anything with relating to your business?
I think we're aware of climate change all the time. Weather patterns in East Africa, at least, are still the monsoon. So you have a wet, dry season that comes in that affects East Africa, Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, for a certain period of time, makes it wet. Doesn't mean you can't travel at that time. But obviously, it means that at some point during the day, you're going to get rain, and that usually is what happens. If you're going to the beach in that time, it tends to be the sea will be a murkier colour than other times when it's clearer and clean. This is the monsoon that's been going for forever. Elsewhere, when you come to the lower latitude, South Africa, you're out of that monsoon period, and you get the four seasons or a different seasonal changes. We have to be aware of climate change, and so trying to be responsible in the way we travel and what we recommend to clients is a big part of it. We purify the water that we get out of wells, so people don't have to buy plastic bottled water if they don't want to. It's available, and if people wish to, they can do, but we encourage people to bring water bottles rather than refill from plastic. And so that sort of thing is always in our mind. So we try to be responsible operators. But we travel in groups of maximum of 24, and often typical, somewhat less than that, 12 to 16. And so our impact on the environment is not so much as a group of, you imagine a group of tourists in Europe, for instance, not criticizing groups in Europe, but where they tend to travel in coaches of 50 or so. Africa is a way much lower down on the impact, the environmental impact of tourism. But it's there, and we have to be aware of it and take what care we can in trying to protect what's there.
With the trips that you do, do you do bespoke experiences where people come to you and get you to create individual itineraries, or is it all set?
Actually, it's a growing part of our business. We traditionally have our set scheduled itineraries. So someone who's traveling on their own, or perhaps a couple who want to join a group or comfortable joining a group, have that. And that's what we've traditionally done, and we continue to do. But we are getting more and more people, whether they're families or small groups, who want to do their own thing. And we'll recommend, or they'll come to us and ask for advice and suggestions. And we've, in fact, I was doing it earlier this morning, is putting together a program for a group that wanted something in the sort of Southern Africa area, but not quite what we do. And that's often what happens. They'll look at our website and say, oh, we quite like this, but is there a possibility, you know, there's 10 of us, say, of doing slightly different? And we do that. So that's an increasing part of our business. So, yeah, to that extent, we try to help where we can.
Obviously, it's a walking podcast, and we talk about walking, but do you do walking as part of some of the set tours that you do?
Yes, indeed. We've got treks on Kilimanjaro, which is the big one for Africa, if you like, because it's a walk. I wouldn't say a walk in the park, but it's a walking destination. You walk or hike to the top on its own, and that tends to be a minimum of 7 days package. But within a number of tours, there's walking opportunities. So, for instance, in Namibia, in the Sossusvlei, which is where the dunes are, biggest dunes in the world, reportedly, you can walk amongst the dunes, you can walk to the top, and you can walk in what's called Deadvlei, which is a bit further down the road. And that's, you know, an hour or two in the with a guide. That's an experience. In Matopos National Park in Zimbabwe, or on foot, walking and tracking white rhino is something that's a real experience, because it's not that common. And obviously safety is something that's uppermost. So you only do that when the guide indicates that it's safe to do so. Other areas where you can walk include, well, the gorillas, I suppose, is the one that, apart from Kilimanjaro, is a popular thing to do. So the gorilla trekking in Uganda, in the west, southwest corner of Uganda, can be an all-day affair. the gorillas have been habituated, which means they're accustomed to the presence of small groups of people every day for a restricted period, usually 1 hour. But where the gorillas roam within the sanctuary varies as to where they wish to roam. So in the company of a tracker and a guard, small groups, usually seven, eight, nine, will track up to where the gorillas were seen the day before. And then it's a matter of tracking them down to find out where they are today. And that can take 3 or 4 hours or even longer, and it's hill trekking. Can be challenging and not to be undertaken without thought. And then often the walk back to camp after it, or back to the park gate, can be much, much shorter because you've essentially gone around in circles tracking them down, and then you just walk back. That's a popular thing to do. And on the same trip, we trek for chimpanzees. Now, chimps are slightly different. Chimps are seen in the trees at a bit of a distance, whereas the gorillas live on the ground, and often you can approach, or they approach you quite closely. The chimps are slightly different. They're in the trees, and you see them at the top of the trees, and you walk through the forest. So there's that sort of thing. The other place that I would think of as part of a trip would be in the Okavango Delta, Botswana, where we camp in the delta itself. So the vehicle is left behind. We travel out there by means of vehicle and boat, depending on how high the level of the delta is. And one of the activities there is walking, a bushwalk, to spot birds largely. But there's elephant out there, there's hippo out there. And that's a real experience that I think people enjoy. For me personally, there's an area of South Africa, in South Africa, called the Drakensberg. And these are a range of hills in KwaZulu-Natal, and they are amazingly spectacular. And I've been there in May, when it's just at the beginning of the Southern Hemisphere winter, and crisp, and very crisp in the mornings and evenings, but delightful during the day. And the scenery is stunning, absolutely stunning. But the change in temperature when the sun goes behind the hill changes from, you know, t-shirt and shorts to you want sweater and long pants within minutes, because the temperature drop is amazing, amazingly steep. So for me, I've got a soft spot for that area because it's just, I've been there a few times and it's just love it. Horse riding too is something that people can do in that area. So those are the areas that I would think of. Mount Kenya is another area, but that's slightly different in that it's a bit like Kilimanjaro when it's 5,000 meters plus. But it's a mountaineering. To get to the peak of Mount Kenya, you actually need proper equipment and climbing. Whereas the beauty of Kilimanjaro is effectively it's a long, steep climb, different routes to get to the highest point in Africa. You know, some of these are parts of the trips, and some others where the point of it is to trek itself.
And I guess the continent itself, not even mentioning countries, there's such a diversity of wildlife and scenery, and it's
yes that's right. And that's comes back to preconceptions of a destination. I imagine every destination people have preconceptions, but Africa is very much it's amazing variety of scenery. It is actually geographically the flattest continent. It doesn't feel like it when you're there, when you're either the Drakensberg in South Africa or the Rift Valley, Kenya, Tanzania, with the Rift Valley forms an amazingly marked valley coming down through the center of the country, continental divide. Or if you're over in southwest Uganda, in the gorillas, that Ruwenzori Mountains between Uganda on the one side and the Democratic Republic of the Congo on the other, 4,000 odd meters high. I mean, they're spectacular. And the one country that we haven't really talked about, because we don't do a great deal there, but it's an amazingly diverse country, is Ethiopia, where there's also trekking and particularly bird watching available. And we haven't touched the cultural areas, the cultural differences and items of interest in Africa, which are enormous. When you think about it, makes sense. If you think an area like Europe has got such a variety of people, cultures, and climates, and you transport that idea to Africa, which is so much bigger, it's not surprising that there's such a variety in Africa.
And I should point out as well, from looking at your website, that you do use an awful lot of local expertise. It's not sort of people that are from other places that you bring in. You use local expertise.
Completely. And that's perhaps one area which has changed since the early days when people like myself were running trips from the top to the bottom, if you like. These days, all our tour leaders and drivers are African, South African, Zimbabwean, Zambian, Kenyan, and they are very, very good. And they treat the job as a career. You know, this is something we've had, got people with us who've been driving and leading tours for 10, 12, 15 years. And they are part of the family and they are really knowledgeable of what they do, taking generations of people on tour. And it's their continent. They've got a pride about showing people their continent. And that's a big part of how the industry's changed for the better. Of course, the other thing that's changed is the service level, so that even though we're talking about trips which run from one country to the other, 3-4 weeks, often people's expectations are higher these days than back in the early days. And naturally, everything's gotten better for them. So the tents are better and the vehicles themselves are better. Seatbelts are required and things like that. With cooking and the meals, I mean, some of the meals I've had in Africa on safari, amazing. And that's down to our tour leaders and drivers and cooks who can produce amazing things off of very simple equipment. I was in Cape Town earlier on this year, and the variety of meals you can get down there and the value for money, amazing. These are things that you discover. You may not travel to Africa for thinking you're in for a culinary delight, but actually within certain limits, most people are surprised, very pleasantly surprised at what they've had on safari.
And one of the good things is that instead of me eating an Ethiopian restaurant in the middle of the US, you're eating it in the actual place and there's all of the ambience that surrounds that.
That's right. And I think this is part of any travel, isn't it? For various reasons, people will choose a destination. When they're there, certainly a place like Africa, it envelops you. It envelops you completely. And even in this day and age with internet and, almost instant communications, I think Africa really has just gives you an absorbing experience. And as I say, certainly from my experience, it gave me a career and changed my life.
You mentioned the obvious ones like Kilimanjaro, but what are some of your favorite kind of maybe out of the way spots that are just amazing? You mentioned South Africa as well.
Well, the one place I do always like and is not so well known, I think, is Malawi. And Malawi is got this wonderful lake, freshwater lake, that takes up 20% of its area, safe for swimming. The bit that I liked about it, and it was when I went there on one of my first trips, was a place called the Nyika Plateau, which is in the north of the country. You drive up, it's a big old drive, you're up to about 3,000 meters, a bit over, roughly 10,000 feet. And the air up there is so clear and it's really refreshing. And yet you're in Africa, so the sun is a burner. But again, when it goes down, that feeling you've got when the day's coming to a close, the light's fading, the temperature's dropping to comfortable 15 degrees, and you've got to put a sweater on. I find that absolutely brilliant. And the views, there's some areas there you can look over Lake Malawi, which is 2,500 meters below you somewhere, and it's awesome, absolutely awesome. And that's an area that I have a soft spot for. I also like Kenya, north of Kenya, north of, when you drive up through Kenya to Mount Kenya, you drive around it, and then you drop down to the Northern Frontier District, which is vast, goes all the way up to Sudan. And I haven't been all the way up to Sudan, but you drop down to Samburu. And again, that's an area which is dry and arid. And I wouldn't say empty, but there's a lot of vacant space. And this is, for me, Africa, it takes you by surprise. And these are not areas that are particularly easy to get to unless you've got some organization behind you, vehicle and an operator. But when you're there, those are the things that stay in mind for me. And the way the light plays on the desert, and if you're depending on where you are, Namibia, for instance, which is known for its desert landscape, vast country. How big is it? France and Spain combined, something like that, with maybe a couple of million people. There's a lot of open space in the desert there, which is not just dunes, but the dunes are just almost look as if they're not real. They are, they're sandy and they're 300-400 meters high, some of them. That's a long way to clamber up. But when the sun goes down and some of the camps we stay, I mean, just the openness and the quiet. And I think for me, that's big attraction of the of any desert, but in Namibia, I found it, certainly had it in the Sahara. But Namibia is a more accessible area to see it.
Oh, darn, more places for my bucket list. While I'd love to go to the places Vivian mentioned, the one that stood out for me was Malawi. I really like getting off the beaten track and going to places that others don't. Although there are tons of interesting places in Africa that we didn't mention, of course. Next, we're talking about The History of Walking. It's an updated book with a new title by a prolific writer for magazines, newspapers, and more than 20 books on, among other things, gardening, homes, and history. And, of course, walking, as we had a great conversation with Bill Laws about his book, A Ramble Through the History of Walking.
Maybe to get it started then, I wonder if you could just give me a little bit of background on your career to date and how that intersects with walking.
Yeah, okay. I got booted out of school a bit early. School and I didn't get on very well. So, in fact, I failed English. So, obviously, I became a journalist. And I've been a freelance journalist all my life, writing mostly about kind of horticulture, vernacular architecture, all those things that I know virtually nothing about. But it's always fun finding out and then sharing what you know. And what I didn't ever write about was walking, which I've always done. I've always loved. I like just putting up one foot in front of the other. And I'm getting increasingly old now in my kind of late to mid 70s. And that's becoming a bit of a strain. So it's more important than ever before for me to enjoy just putting one foot in front of the other. Might be just walking up the end of the street, going up to the local cafe and getting a cup of coffee. But that did lead me to put together this book, A Ramble Through the History of Walking, as it's now called. It is a rewrite. I first wrote it, gosh, about 15 years ago. And I suppose it's kind of, I love people. I'm fascinated by people. I love reading about the people who walked. I just quote from the back, Robert Louis Stevenson, the great author of Treasure Island, all those classics, what he says, the great affair is to move, to come down off this featherbed of civilization and find the globe granite underfoot, which I think he wrote when he was, he was walking the Cevennes with his donkey, travels with a donkey. It's a great story because he's a great storyteller. I think he's also possibly the inventor of the bivy bag. I mean, I think some of your listeners will counter that, but I think he could lay good claim to it. You know, he had this idea of a rolled up bedroll. His donkey, Modestine, he hated Modestine at the start of the journey. He loved her by the end because she was a patient soul. And over it hung this sort of bedroll filled with everything. Coffee pot, side of ham, and a pistol in case of problems. So it's, you know, it's people like that that really kind of grabbed me. And I kind of put them together into this history of walking and rambling. I'm very connected with local history. We live in lovely rural Herefordshire. I actually live in the middle of the city now, but we're newcomers in that. We've been here 40 years. But I've always been interested in its local history. And I think I'd be interested in its local history, you know, wherever I was, if I was up with you in air or whatever. I'm fascinated by the past, but also how it is local. Hereford's past, we might, and Ayr's past, we might share the same events, but how they play out locally is very different. And I think that, to pull myself back on this ramble, that ramblers tend to do this, you know, particularly the ones who write and walk. They do observe. You do observe what's going around, you know, what's going on locally. You see you walk in my local mountains, hardly a mountain, but it's the Black Mountains. You see a stone up there and you think, I wonder what that stone is. And then you kind of do a bit of digging and you find, oh my goodness, it marks the murder of one of King Offa's followers, which indeed it does. So I love that thing about people who've written about walking.
It's very difficult to get that balance of the content of a walking book because of all of the different aspects to the walking, as you were mentioning. I think it's a very difficult thing to master.
Yes, I think passion counts. Canon Cooper, he was a passionate walker. The rector of Filey in Yorkshire decides to walk to Rome in, I'm looking up my notes here, 1887. But as a trial run, he thinks, well, it's not too bad to walk from Filey to London. I'll do that. So he finishes the Nunc Dimittis on a Sunday night and puts on his best walking gear, including a pound note sewn into my unmentionables, and sets off for the bank in his bank in London, walks there and walks back. That helps him to decide that he can do the walk to Rome, which of course he does very successfully. So passionate walkers. One I really like is John Hillaby. Sadly, long dead. Well, not long dead. Was he writing in the 60s, 70s? Again, somebody who walked to write and wrote to walk. Journey through Britain, journey through England, his observations on his journeying, I just find them delightful. Often it's encounters with people. And of course, Hillaby is a great exponent of the brief naked walking episode, you know, where we've all done it probably. It gets very hot. I mean, here we are chatting on one of the what's going to turn out to be the hottest day of the year. And don't tell me there isn't somebody up on the Black Mountains or the Trossachs who's just thought, oh, sod this, and stripped off and, you know, enjoyed the air on their body. So John Hillaby used to do that fairly regularly. He did find himself having to crouch behind a minuscule bush on one occasion when he suddenly found a lady on horseback coming his way. I love little details like that.
We should be talking about you as opposed to other writers, but the book that you mentioned, it first came out in 2008 and it had a different title. Is it different to the original, and why the change of title, and I guess why the update in 2025?
Yeah, the clue is in the date you just mentioned of when it came out. Because like me, like you, I am a media person. I'm plugged into media. And we've had the World Wide Web. Mr. Tim Berners-Lee has gifted us the most extraordinary transformation in media lives. And that transformation happened between, it was originally called Byways, Boots and Blisters, which I'm very grateful for one of my walking companions, Steffi Ross, coming up with the idea for the title. But that was written before the web. So the publishers, History Press, came back to me and said, well, we think this book still has legs, but it needs a kick up the backside. It needs to be written with a more contemporary feel. So we haven't lost Hillaby or Canon Cooper or all the rest of it. But I have had a wayward glance as I go on Google and on Wikipedia, and it is transformational. Nevertheless, the book is very often, obviously it's based on, particularly if I'm talking about the 19th century, 18th century, on what people have written. So I'm kind of farming their material in the same way, I suppose, as AI is farming my material. I'm horrified to discover, but this is what we have to live with. But get back to the book. What this celebrates is just that whole thing about, we talked about this at the beginning, putting one foot in front of another. A very dear friend, who's a much better writer than I, said to me how she was very inspired by this book. She's just come back from walking in Sweden. She's an adventurous walker. And she said, what your book reminds me to do is just walk, down the end of the street, round the farmer's field, walk to school. These great sort of campaigns that are going on at the moment, have been to get us off our backsides, onto our bikes, onto our feet. We all know it's good for us. I think you had a very interesting speaker in the last podcast from Brighton and Hove, emphasizing the sense of well-being that walking gives you. And my goodness, it does. And like me, I'm sure you know this thing. You know, I'm just trying to update some written material now. And it's not that you get writer's block or any of that stuff. You just think, I need to refresh. You go outside, dripping with rain. Not today, where it's as hot as hell. It doesn't matter what the weather is. That moment of being outside and on your own two feet and in motion helps move things along.
I think sometimes it's the motivation that's the missing part. Once you're walking, you love it, but it's just that there are so many other ways to spend your time that people just tend not to, unfortunately.
Yeah, Jim, isn't it funny that so many walking clubs revolve around the pub at the end of the journey, or or sometimes the tea cafe. Very sensible thing. I love that thing about walking clubs. I think the more the better, the more the merrier. I mean, I think there are other issues to do with walking, which I hope the book does, in a sense, highlight. There is a political dimension to this. You hailed from across the border, where the right to roam exists. I'm south of the border, where the right to roam doesn't exist. And we are led to believe by my journalistic colleagues that there's some great dissension over this idea that somehow landowners are trying to keep us out. Well, yes, some landowners do, and irresponsible tiny walkers are trying to break down gates and let the sheep out in their efforts to secure the right to roam. Of course, this is nonsense. Everybody, most of the farmers I've ever met, most of the landowners, and certainly most of the walkers I've ever met, believe that we all need to be out and about and sharing this kind of lovely countryside that we have. There are less of these signs around these days, but the private no trespassing sign, trespassers will be prosecuted. One walker, Leslie Stevens, the husband of Vanessa Bell and Virginia Woolf, was a substantial business to produce those two girls. He called them the wooden liars. Because, of course, it's not a criminal offence, but it is a civil offence. And Leslie Stevens, I mean, he's very home counties. I think he set up the Sunday Trampers, or Tramps, which has got to be one of the earliest walking clubs. And they had a Lord Chief Justice, I believe, who was one of the members, and who devised this rebuff or response to being challenged in the act of trespass. And that was to say to the surprised landowner or ghillie or whatever it was, "My good man, I mean no damage or harm to the land of your land which I just crossed. And please may I make amends," and to produce one penny and present it to the surprised chap by way of recompense. And that way, there was just no question about you being prosecuted for trespass.
Obviously, people in every country in the world go walking, but the book kind of has that British feel to it. Why do you think that the British have seemingly a different relationship with walking to other places?
What a question. And I know you've spent time in Canada, as I have, and the States. I love France. I love Europe. They don't have the same passion. We've got hedges and walkers and they haven't. Is it just down to that? There is something very peculiar about it. There is something really rather eccentric about the nature of British walkers. I think the BBC Countryfile magazine says very kindly, "This book confirms the splendid eccentricity of the British, which often involves oddly dressed men opting to walk long distances for no apparent reasons." Which is very true. None truer than, I'm just holding up the little tome, The Gentle Art of Tramping by Stephen Graham. He walked to write and wrote to walk. He had a job briefly, I think, in the early 1900s, and he gave it up and sort of walked to the world. When he kind of settled down, he had some great ideas on unconventional walking. One was, we've just been talking about trespassing, the trespass walk. And he recommended taking your compass, setting a route, and then following it in a straighter route, as faithful to the route as possible. As he said, apologizing to any lady who might be in her private swimming pool, repairing the damage to any hedge you've just climbed through, and apologizing to any peppery squire you meet. And he said that you might get this idea that it would be met with great consternation and opposition. But he said, far from it. Most people were very welcoming of you appearing on their land. He had a more reasonable route, for very, very good for urban walking, the zigzag walk or the left turn. And they are as they sound. The left turn is essentially keep turning left, set off with your umbrella and your, hopefully not your pistol, your rucksack, and keep turning left. If you come back on yourself, obviously you've done too small a walk. And the zigzag walk, which I think he took with his wife on honeymoon in London, and he recommended, perhaps we should all do this, honeymooners, to take their honeymoon as a walking holiday. And for that, he did the zigzag, which is, again, as it sounds, you set off, you have no idea where you're going to go, but you turn left at the first opportunity, right at the next, left at the next, and so on. Until exhausted, you fall into the local pub. It's funny. I end the book on a note that I haven't been able to find elsewhere. I shared this, sounds like I'm showing off, but I was very delighted to be invited on Claire Balding's Ramblings to wander up the Alcan Valley. Gosh, when the first book came out, and we talked about that whole business about why people walk. As I say, I end the book on a story of a munitioneer. During the First and Second World War, Hereford had a very large munitions factory. And in the First World War, this interest I have in local history allowed me to interview, I think the only interview I know of in this area, certainly, Annie Mary Slade, a little Welsh lady from Pentre in the valleys. And she had come up here. She was a munitions worker. But she said, it really caught my attention. She said, when we went back to the valleys, of course, it was in the Depression, it was the 20s. Times were so hard. I'd done a lot of walking. And what she did was they had walking competitions up the valleys, over the hills, for women, presumably for men as well. But I don't think she was competing against men. And the winner would receive food, a box of potatoes was one prize. And she was very successful at it. Her only problem was that she didn't have any proper walking gear. And a neighbour had lent her a walking skirt, whatever a walking skirt is. And I think that really is just to emphasise the richness of this whole walking, the story of walking and rambling.
There's lots of stories in the book. What are some of your own favourites of maybe the eccentricities or the idiosyncrasies of walking?
Gosh, there are so many. I love Hilaire Belloc's monumental pilgrimage to Rome. I love when they list what they carry. I mean, we mentioned Canon Cooper's coin sewn into his unmentionables.
There are so many anecdotes and so many strange things in there. It's like putting this thing together must have been a joy in itself.
It was a joy in itself. Business about writing and walking. So am I a writing walker or a walking writer? Robert Louis Stevenson was asked the same when he puts up at a monastery one evening. And the friar says, invite you into take the evening meal with us. What are you? And he says, well, I'm a writer. Oh, says the friar, could I not introduce you as a geographer? No, says Stevenson, I am a writer. "Very well, then," says the friar very reluctantly, "an author." And I do have a writer friend who's, it says on his passport, writer, but it could be mistaken for waiter. And I think quite often he will say, no, it's okay, I'm a waiter. A key part of being a writer
is waiting around for everything. So something that did make me smile, and it's got nothing to do with the book, is in your acknowledgements when you mention apologizing to your children about shortcuts. I think that's maybe a perfect example of what walking does to people, because it turns you into a confident and intrepid explorer when you maybe aren't, and you say, "No, we're going this way," or "We just take a left here," and it's only another half an hour when you know full well it's 2 hours. It just seems to, walking transforms us somehow.
Getting lost, it's the great thing. And Stephen Graham, you know, he purposefully got lost, but GPS and my wonderful iPhone, where would I be without it? And then you get up a mountain and you say, "Oh, blooming heck, it's not working." Yes, that whole business of getting lost. I have a particular affection for Francis Kilvert, the clergyman who kept sadly such a brief diary and died so young, and him trekking up Cader Idris with a guide. And the guide is a wily old soul, Mr. Pugh. I think Mr. Pugh turns up in several sort of Victorian accounts of walking Cader Idris. And they've recently recovered the body of some poor clerk who died on the mountainside the year before. And he regales Kilvert with this state of this decomposed poor walker, leaving Kilvert really very troubled and nervous. And then that awful thing that happens when you're up the top and the weather drops and you suddenly think, "Oh my goodness, I can't see a blooming thing." And Pugh says, "Well, I think we might have to spend the night on the mountain." And Kilvert has heard this local story that spend the night on Cader Idris and you'll end up in the morning dead or mad or a poet. Unfortunately, the weather lifts. Mr. Pugh gets the Reverend Kilvert back to his local hostelry. And Mr. Pugh says, "Reverend Kilvert, you are a very good walker," which, of course, earns him a double whiskey. Job done.
With your book, though, all of these older books and writers from different eras, do you think that that's been lost? I mean, can you envisage some of the travel writers of today being collected in a volume like this 100 years from now?
I think I can. I think that one of the biggest elements that's missing out of my book is the coverage of women walkers. And women tended to walk, but they didn't get published very much. I mean, I love Dorothy Wordsworth. She is such a delight. And there are several women who are mentioned. I'm an eternal optimist. I get confused by the media today and the way that we, I mean, I think it's a tragedy that we've lost our local newspapers. I dearly hope our national papers won't go the same way. But at the same time, other things are happening. Podcasts, wonderful things. So I think that the material is still being generated, and if anything, more material than before. We spoke about, you know, getting your children lost. And we've got three daughters. I'm delighted to say they all forced their children out onto the hills. You know, you find a love of walking, you pass it on, and it'll go on to the next generation. So, no, I'm very optimistic. I think there's a great deal of walking history yet to be written.
But why do you think it is that some walkers, like the ones in your book, but not exclusively those in your book, become so revered and respected? I'm thinking of people like Wainwright, who, when you mention walking and Cumbria, his seems to be the only name that pops up.
The world of publishing, I mean, my goodness, I think I'm on my 24th or 25th. I'm just writing a book on the Herefordshire Pomona, sort of 19th century apple tome. But to get a book published is still incredibly hard. And it has happened on a bit of a network, not exactly an old boys network. That certainly was the case when I started out in writing and publishing. It has changed, but it is still, I don't know, I wrote a book about artist gardens. Obviously, if you write about artist gardens, you've got to have Mr. Monet. It's got to be the main thing. And of course, it's just nonsense. And I think our modern media is much more diverse, is much more open to new ideas. It's much bigger, unfortunately. And how you make your voice heard, I'm not sure. But I think we'll be okay.
That was a conversation that actually lasted for more than an hour and had lots of laughs in it. Hopefully Bill writes another walking book so we can have him on again, unless he's already blocked my email. More good weather is forecast for this weekend. Actually very hot weather for UK standards. I see that in terms of weather and very hot weather, some US politicians have written to the government in Canada complaining that smoke from the wildfires there is ruining their summer in the US. Yep, those fires were set on purpose just to annoy the southern neighbours. Anyway, that's it for another podcast. If you have news or suggestions for podcast guests, please do get in touch through jim@walkingpost.com. I hope you enjoyed this week's walkingpost.com podcast, and I hope that you have a great week ahead, hopefully with a walk somewhere, even if it is just to the fridge for another cold beverage. So, until next time, happy trails! Walking Post from walkingpost.com is an Air Coastal Media Limited production.